Okay, so I think the title is basically what I'm going to follow. Half of my talk is going to be on this first subject, spontaneous stochasticity, and then the other half is on MHD and fast reconnection. So there's a lot of overlap with what Alex Lazarin was talking about the other day, but you won't see that at first. It will look like I'm talking about something completely different. This subject of spontaneous stochasticity, in my opinion, is probably one of the most interesting and important things to come out of turbidence research in the last 15 years. It's actually something very surprising, and I'm going to try to convince you that it has a lot of important implications. It's not my work, unfortunately. I didn't discover this, but I think it's actually quite important. The roots of it actually, however, go back quite a long time. It's actually implicit in Richardson's original work in 1926 on two-particle diffusion. So Grisha has asked me to start from the very beginning and go very slowly, so I'm going to go through some of this. Some of the people in the audience know this very well, and others may know it a little less well. But Richardson was studying in 1926 this process of how particles disperse in a turbident flow. So, for example, would be a pair of ash particles in this volcanic plume, how they separate in time. And he proposed his now famous Richardson T-cubed law that says that that squared separation, the mean squared separation, grows like the third power of the time. Okay, now how did he actually get this result? Well, it was semi-empirical. First of all, he proposed that if I look at the distribution of the particle separation vectors, that that would actually obey a kind of diffusion equation, but with a scale-dependent eddy diffusivity. And he got the eddy diffusivity empirically. So actually, here is from his original paper, his table of data. It's actually a quite heterogeneous set of data. He actually even looked at molecular diffusion at small distances, and then anemometers. He looked at pilot balloons. He looked at diffusion in cyclones, volcanic ash.
21 plus 26 data, only 26?
Pardon?
There was 1921 and 1926.
This is 1926.
26.
This is out of his 1926 paper, yeah. And so out of this data, he then made an estimate of the diffusivity by looking at the mean square separation divided by the time. And by fitting this data, he said, well, it looks like it grows like the four-thirds power of the distance. Okay. That immediately actually leads to this prediction here. Let me say a little bit more in detail how that comes out. This Richardson diffusion equation has an exact similarity solution. It's actually given by a stretched exponential PDF. This was actually observed in Richardson's original paper in one dimension. Here I've written out the solution for the three-dimensional case. All solutions of that diffusion equation asymptotically approach this self-similar form at long times. And if you just multiply this equation by L squared and integrate, then out pops this T cubed law. So that's actually the derivation that Richardson gave as an original 1926 paper. Now, think of this. This is 1926. This was before Kolmogorov's theory in 1941. But it turns out that Richardson is completely compatible with Kolmogorov's 1941 theory. And so you have the classical Kolmogorov picture. You inject energy at large scale. It cascades down to small scales. The important thing about the Kolmogorov picture is that it says that the velocity increments across an eddy of a particular size actually depends, like the size of that eddy to the cube root, to the one-third power. And so what that means is you look at larger eddies, they have larger relative velocities. And that actually explains this T cubed. Note in particular that T cubed is bigger than T squared. That's ballistic motion. The particles are not separating at a constant speed. As they separate, they encounter larger eddies with larger relative velocities, and it makes them separate even faster. So the separation is super ballistic. It goes like T cubed. Okay, so it's actually a very, very simple physics that's involved here. It's just that you're seeing advection by these larger size eddies with larger relative velocities. And I think it's important to appreciate that out of this extremely simple physics, some very surprising consequences arise. Okay, so that's what I'm going to try to convince you of first. But before I do that, let me just show you more quantitatively how you can get the Richardson predictions out of a K41 type calculation. Okay, so if I take the relative separation of the particles and I take the time derivative, that's related to the difference in the velocity of the two particles. But in a K41 theory, that goes like the separation distance to the 1/3 power. Here I put in the prefactor so that I get the right constant here. But anyways, that's not an important thing. This is a simple exercise in first year calculus or differential equations. You can solve this ODE by separation of variables. Here's the exact solution. And what you see is that at long times, where you can forget this initial separation, or maybe better yet, in terms of a dimensionally correct quantity, divide through by this quantity, this defines something with dimensions of time that depends on that initial separation. And for long times bigger than this time, what you see is this T cubed law. So this is showing you how you actually quantitatively get the T cubed out of a K41 style theory. Okay, now this all looks rather innocuous, okay, if you're thinking about it the way I just said, but suppose we look at it in a different way, okay? Suppose that instead of looking at long times bigger than this time here, suppose I consider the viscosity getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and I let this L0 also go to zero at the same time. Well, this solution here has a very strange property. In that limit, where the two particles are taken to be at exactly the same initial point, they end up at later times separating to a finite distance. Okay? So that what that means is I've considered a limit now where I get the particles starting at exactly the same place, and they end up at later times going to different positions. Okay, so it looks like it breaks down usual Laplacian determinism. And in fact, it does in this limit. Now, you might think that this is just an odd feature of this little toy calculation that I just did, but in fact, the same thing happens in the Richardson diffusion equation. So if you take that self-similar solution that Richardson found, this one right here, if I go and I set time t equal to zero, I look at the initial time, this thing actually just becomes a delta function. So that means this self-similar solution corresponds to all the particles starting off at one point, zero separation. But then at a later time, any positive time, I've got a nice smooth PDF. And that means that later time, with probability 1, the particles have separated to some finite distance. Or another way of saying that, the probability that the separation remains 0 is 0. Okay? So all the particles start off at the same location, and then they go somewhere else. Yes?
Does this depend on the power that you put in?
The basic phenomenon does not depend on it, as long as, so instead of 1/3, I could have anything between 0 and 1.
Right.
Okay, as long as it's not smooth. In fact, that's my next slide. Thank you, Joachim.
So it would work for ordinary diffusion.
Pardon?
It would work for ordinary diffusion.
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that. Of course, if I have ordinary diffusion with Brownian motion, mm-hmm. that's already random. Here, everything is deterministic, right? Okay. So I'd have to understand exactly more carefully what you mean by that. Here, there's nothing random. It's just purely deterministic advection. There will be some randomness I'll put in later, and we'll talk about that. But okay, so now it looks like this is violating the usual idea of Laplacian determinism. You know, Laplace says you give me the position of every particle in the universe and its velocity, and I'll predict the future forever. And it does. But isn't this a theorem? I mean, how can it possibly violate it? Well, you always have to look at theorems. You know, theorems are like legal contracts, and they can have loopholes in them. And there's a loophole in this particular contract, because if you look back at the theorems on uniqueness of solutions of ordinary differential equations, they require that the velocity be Holder continuous with an exponent greater than or equal to 1. So in other words, you have to satisfy a condition like this with h greater than or equal to 1. And then you have uniqueness of solutions of the ordinary differential equations. But this Kolmogorov velocity corresponds to h equals 1/3. And so that uniqueness theorem doesn't have to apply anymore. Okay? So now you can actually have solutions of this equation that start at the same point and they end up going in different places. You get non-unique solutions of the ordinary differential equation. Okay. Now, everything I said looks like, well, okay, that's kind of a mathematical game, but the important thing is that actually it turns out that this non-uniqueness happens in very physical limits, and it has a lot of important physical implications for a variety of different problems. Everything that I've said up until now was actually noted in a seminal paper of Bernard, Goretzky, and Kupiainen. Dennis Bernard is either here now or is about to appear.
No, apparently he's not coming. Just by mistake is listed in the program.
Ah, no, too bad. Okay. So anyways, you will not have the chance of talking with him in any case, but this is a very important seminal work, and they actually studied this soluble model of advection. Instead of looking at the real turbulent velocity, they considered the problem of advection with a Gaussian velocity field that has this particular correlation structure here. Now that looks a little complicated, but there are two sort of essential things here. One is that in time, the correlation is temporal white noise. And that actually has importance because it actually is what guarantees that Richardson's diffusion approximation becomes exact. Okay, so when you have this white noise correlation in time, the Richardson part of the Richardson diffusion equation is no longer a hypothesis, it's actually a theorem. Okay. The other thing is that it's also this correlation, the spatial part here, is spatially rough. So it's like a Kolmogorov-type inertial range, but then going back to Joachim's point, I don't necessarily require that I have the Kolmogorov value here. I can take anything between 0 and 1, okay? And of course, I don't need it to be really rough over all scales. The important thing is I can have a cutoff. So I have, this is like a pseudo-viscous cutoff. Everything can become smooth below that point, which would correspond to h equals 1. And this is kind of a nice laboratory for studying the realistic advection problem with a rough velocity field on a long range of scales. Okay, so the important thing again is if I take the limit, however, as nu goes to 0, then I get things that are really rough on all the range of scales. Okay, if you're looking very carefully here, you may say, aha, there's something funny here, and you're right. Notice that this is the eddy diffusivity in the Richardson sense. This is r to the 2h. It's for h equals 2/3 that you get the 4/3 value of Richardson, not for the Kolmogorov case. And that's because of the white noise problem, character of this problem. Okay. So it's actually for h equals 2/3 that you get the original Richardson equation. Okay, now what did these guys study in this problem? They studied the problem of stochastic particle advection. So going back to your point, what I can do is I can now take this velocity field. Notice I keep this regularization parameter here. So this is not really rough. It's not really non-differentiable. As long as I keep nu fixed, it's actually a smooth at sufficiently small scales. And then I'm going to add here this extra Brownian term. Okay. And you can write down an exact path integral solution for the Green's function, the transition probability for this particular stochastic advection problem. Here's what that path integral looks like. And if you just stare at this, you'll say, well, if I take the limit as kappa goes to 0, actually I can look either here or here. If I take the limit as kappa goes to 0, I just get back ordinary deterministic advection, right? If I look at it here, I can see the same thing. If I take kappa goes to 0, then by steepest descent, what should dominate is where this thing becomes a minimum. Well, the minimum value is 0 when I'm solving the deterministic ODE. And so this Green's function should concentrate on just one single deterministic trajectory. And you're correct that that is what happens if I take kappa going to 0 for fixed nu. But if I take kappa and nu going to 0 together, and again, I'm not talking about actually setting them to 0. I'm just saying let's consider the limit where they both get smaller and smaller and smaller together. Then what happens is that this never concentrates to a delta function. It stays random. Okay. In fact, for this Kraichin model, that's a theorem. It's actually known rigorously that it does not concentrate to a delta function. As you let kappa get smaller and smaller, and as nu gets smaller and smaller together, then this distribution of trajectories stay random. They do not collapse to a single trajectory. Okay. And in fact, in a mean square sense, The typical separation of the trajectories in the Richardson case, of course, this would correspond to taking H equals 2/3 in the Krejcin model or H equals 1/3 in realistic turbulence. The typical separation is going, in fact, like T^3/2. Okay.
You know, history, Anzager never foresaw this. Anzager did not have this kind of mental picture of this non-unique trajectories, because he knew that velocity is non-smooth in the limit and all this.
Yeah, I never saw it in Anzager. There is sort of a glimmer of it in Kolmogorov.
You're responsible for Anzager.
Yeah. So there is sort of a glimmer of it in Kolmogorov, but I never saw any specific statement about this by Anzager. So the point is that in this particular limit, you actually end up with an infinite set of solutions. In fact, what happens is known in this problem is that you do, in fact, end up this distribution settling on solutions of this ordinary differential equation. It just turns out that there are infinitely many solutions of that ordinary differential equation with the same initial condition in the limit we're considering, and that's what this distribution is setting on. Okay? So now you have infinitely many solutions with the same initial condition. There are various terms that have been used to describe this phenomenon. I like spontaneous stochasticity. That was actually, some people call it intrinsic stochasticity, but I like spontaneous stochasticity because it makes a good analogy with spontaneous symmetry breaking. So, you know, like in a ferromagnet, it's known that when you're below the Curie temperature, if you take the external magnetic field going to zero, you keep a magnetization. You have a so-called spontaneous magnetization, even in the limit where the external magnetic field goes to zero. And this is sort of an analogous phenomenon. Okay, so you have some external noise that you've added to the system right here, but even in the limit where this goes to zero, if simultaneously nu goes to zero, the trajectories stay random. They do not become deterministic. Okay. Let me make one important point here. This kind of randomness is extremely different than the way that randomness usually enters into turbulence theory. You should not get confused about that. Ordinarily, in turbulence, when you're talking about randomness, you're talking about averaging over an ensemble of velocity fields. Everything that I've said here is for a fixed velocity field. I'm not averaging over velocity fields. I'm looking at one realization out of my ensemble of velocity fields, and these particle trajectories are random for every fixed individual realization of the velocity. Okay. That's actually, again, a theorem for this Krejcin-Kazantsev model. But again, all they used to prove that theorem is Richardson's diffusion equation. All the analysis is based on that.
So, Gregory, then the Hölder continuity condition on U is, I should think of that as being, I mean, the average that you take there is like a spatial average, or?
No, there's no average. I mean, there's no spatial average at all. I mean, all the source of randomness in what I'm saying here is coming from this external Brownian motion. That's the only source of randomness in the way I present it here. You can also consider other sources of randomness by taking the initial conditions randomly. I'll talk about that a little bit later.
So the Hölder continuity,
but
it's just pointwise essentially, anywhere.
Well, for this Gaussian random field, it's actually a monofractal velocity.
Right, at every point of your velocity field, you must have, it's called Lipschitz condition.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm saying, so in this monofractal case, you have the same Hölder exponent everywhere, right? Okay.
Is there an analogy of Curie temperature for this?
Is there in some sense, the Curie temperature, the thing that is, in some sense, is the analogous to the temperature is the Hölder exponent. This phenomenon only occurs for Hölder exponent less than 1.
Okay.
If you have Hölder exponent bigger than 1, then this phenomenon doesn't occur. So that would be sort of the analog of the temperature here. Yeah. Okay. Now, some of you may say, well, wait a minute, is this really new? Isn't this just chaos? And the answer is no, this is very distinctly different than chaos. Let me just point out, you can understand the difference just by looking at a little cartoon like I looked at before. Take the smooth case of my cartoon, in which case the Hölder exponent is 1. Well, then again, this is a simple exercise in calculus to solve this equation, and the solution looks like this. And so again, with smooth dynamics, the maximal separation that you can see is exponential, which is actually what you see in chaotic dynamics. But what's very important is that in this solution, the initial separation appears as a prefactor. Okay. And when you let L0 go to 0 at any fixed time later, no matter how long you wait, but you look at some fixed time later, if I let L0 go to 0, L of T vanishes. That's not what happened in the case that I looked at before. So that means that the whole trajectory will collapse to a single thing. Or another way of saying this is that in chaos, if I give you any finite precision, okay, so L0 would correspond to my precision and knowledge of the initial conditions, after a sufficiently long time, I'll eventually, because of this exponential growth, lose all ability to predict. Okay, but with spontaneous stochasticity, I can give you infinitely many decimal places in the initial condition. I can know the initial condition perfectly, and I still can't predict what's going to happen. Okay, and again, you can see this formally in terms of the definition of the Lyapunov exponent, which measures chaos. In the definition of the Lyapunov exponent, which I've given here, it's always important that you divide through by this L0. That's part of the definition of the Lyapunov exponent. Just saying again, what you really want to measure is this exponential separation here. You divide that out. Okay. In the case of spontaneous stochasticity, this Lyapunov exponent is actually infinite, okay? Because as you let L0 go to 0, this quantity does not vanish, and so this blows up. Okay, so spontaneous stochasticity is in some sense more chaotic than chaos. It actually corresponds to having infinite Lyapunov exponents. Okay. Well, what are some of the interesting physical implications of this? These were explored in this paper of Bernard and Goretzky and Kupiainen. They were particularly interested in this problem of turbulent scalar advection. So that's governed by this scalar advection diffusion equation. How does this relate to the Lagrangian trajectories? Well, basically, you can solve this equation by a method of stochastic characteristics. Okay, so this is just a stochastic generalization of the usual method of characteristics for solving this equation when kappa is 0. And the solution looks like this. Okay, so you basically take that same transition probability that I wrote before, and it now acts like the Green's function for solving this scalar advection problem. Notice it's important here that I'm integrating over the final times. In other words, over the initial times. So in other words, here this is actually the probability that I start at x at time t. That's the later time. And then I want to know the probability that they were at x0 at the earlier time, t0. So now I'm actually looking at stochastic advection backward in time. Okay, which if you think about it is the natural causal direction because the scalar field is an average of its earlier time values, not of the future time values, right? You don't know what the future values are. So when you're solving this equation forward in time, the solution averages over the initial data. Okay. You can also write this out then in terms of a path integral formula. But again, what this really just means is that now in this path integral formula, this actually corresponds to taking this stochastic advection equation for fixed conditions at the final time to be at position x, and then going backward in time and sampling what the initial data were and averaging those. And that's just an exact representation of the solution of this equation. Okay, well, one of the interesting implications of this is the so-called dissipative anomaly. So as many of you know, in a turbulent flow, if I just look at the conservation of this scalar intensity or scalar substance, if I take the time derivative of this, according to the original equation, I get a term that looks like this that seemingly vanishes in the limit as kappa goes to 0. Okay. As a matter of fact, it's known from experiment and simulation that that seems not to be the case. As you let kappa goes to 0, this thing actually does not vanish. Okay. This spontaneous stochasticity actually gives a very elegant Lagrangian representation of that, because in the limit, if I take my solution here, okay, which I've written down here, I can take the limit of this solution right here, and the limit is nu and kappa both go to 0. And what I've already told you is that in that limit, this Green's function does not collapse to a delta function. One way of saying this is that the molecular diffusion actually gets replaced by turbulent diffusion. Okay, and so this thing actually stays random in that limit, and now my scalar at the final time at position x is actually an average over the initial scalar at a random set of positions through this turbulent mixing process. Now, because this quantity is convex, the value of the average has to be less than or equal to the average of the values, and you can therefore immediately infer from this equation that this quantity has to decrease in time. And so again, this follows directly from the fact that this thing stays random in the limit, okay? So the basic mechanism from a Lagrangian point of view of this dissipative anomaly is that you continue to mix the scalar through this turbulent mixing process, even in the limit where the molecular mixing goes to zero. Okay, so this is a nice way of understanding this dissipative anomaly for the scalar case. And again, this was all pointed out in this paper, Bernard Goedsky and Kupiainen. Okay, now, since this seems to be a really interesting phenomenon, you're interested in saying, well, is it actually true? Okay, so far, what I've shown you are predictions of Richardson, and I've shown you exact mathematical results about Richardson's equation, but Richardson's diffusion equation, is not exact for turbulent flow, right? So you say, is this true or not? Okay, this is quite interesting. Is it actually what you see? So now Eberhardt is here at the right time, okay. I'm going to have the temerity to speak about his experiments right in front of him, but I'm not going to say a lot. I'm going to whisk over those rather quickly, and then you can talk to Eberhardt about them yourself. But they published a nice paper in Science in 2006 in which they actually searched for Richardson diffusion. They have the typical French washing machine type configuration illuminated with lasers. Here you can actually see the particles running around and taking all that nice work and jumping over it. I'll just show you their results. They did not see Richardson. Okay, so that's the first thing. What they actually see is something that was predicted later, around 1950 by Batchelor, which is a T-squared separation, just pure ballistic separation. So actually they have their data here, and they, as they emphasize, this is not a fit, this is just the T-squared that you get. And what they see is you do not forget this initial particle separation, and you get this nice T-squared law. Now, they also looked for this Richardson stretched exponential. Batchelor predicted that you don't get a stretched exponential, you actually get a Gaussian PDF of the separations from his theory. And mainly what they saw was an agreement with the Batchelor predictions. Here you can see the data, and also the green line here is Batchelor's Gaussian prediction. And most of their data falls directly on that. But then when they look at the smallest separation, so again, these things depend on what the initial separations of the particles were. Here they're gradually decreasing the initial separations. The smallest separation is something like 30 Kolmogorov lengths. And then at that smallest separation, they're starting to see now something falling on this red line, which is the Richardson prediction. Okay, now my interpretation of this result is that they have not looked at small enough separations. Okay, so remember, in order to see this Richardson phenomenon, you have to go long enough that you forget that initial time, but that initial time depends on the distance that the particles were initially separated. Okay, and so if they could, but they can't, take smaller separations, I think they would see it in this flow. I'll try to justify that in a moment. But if they can't take the particle separation smaller, then they have to do something else. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But they actually tried to see if they could see something Richardson-like. And so actually this is, I think, is in a following paper. And here they process the data a little differently. If you look at this two-thirds power, then the same dimensional reasoning, or actually if you use Richardson's self-similar solution, this would also pop out. Then you would expect that this thing should scale linearly in time, because I've now taken a two-thirds power here. Okay, so they said, well, let's look for this kind of modified Richardson scaling law. And so they take this quantity here, okay, and they divide through by time. So you see here they divided through by t over t0. t0 is this initial time that depends on the particle separation. If this law is correct, then they should see a plateau, okay. And you can sort of look at this and say, well, I do see something like a plateau there, don't I? Okay. So you can say, well, maybe Richardson is kind of right. They also looked at this constant, and remember, in order to see Richardson, you need good separation in time. You need to have, there's this initial time set by the initial particle separations, and then there's the large-scale integral turnover time. Notice that in Richardson's theory, in one large-scale eddy turnover time, the particles separate to an integral length, okay? So it's not meaningful to go beyond that time. And so you need a large separation in times between those two. And so they actually looked at this effective constant coming from this plateau value for these different time ratios. And here's their data, okay? And as they increase the Reynolds number, they get more points out here. What you would really like to see is that this thing plateaus to a constant, right? And so they sort of convinced themselves, well, if you're going to see Richardson at all, you probably have to go to a Taylor scale Reynolds number about 10 times this. Right?
6,000,
yeah. Yeah, something like that. So Ebersard says, well, once he's convinced of that, go ahead and do it, okay? So they're doing it now, okay? And so here's their current facility. They've got, actually, it's a very nice experiment. I've never seen it in person, only virtually. But they've got sulfur hexafluoride, I guess, what is it, 15 tons, 12 tons?
Tunnel has 9.
Tunnel has 9, okay. Pressurized to 15 bars, okay. So again, the kinematic viscosity is the molecular viscosity divided by the density. So as you increase the density, the kinematic viscosity goes down. And so they, in order to get high Reynolds number, they also pressurize it. And doing all this, they can get Taylor scale Reynolds numbers up to this, I guess even higher now, right? You said like...
This is pretty much the maximum.
Pretty much the maximum, okay. So now they can actually go ahead and try to see this. They can't take the particles closer together, but now because they have a higher Reynolds number, they can integrate longer in time and hopefully forget what those initial separations are and see if they see it or not. Okay, so the verdict is still out. Now, people have also looked at this using numerical simulations. This is not the latest work. There's actually a more recent work of Sawford and Young. I'm not going to show their results, although they're at somewhat higher Reynolds number because they didn't show the data in the same way that I want to present it here. So I'm actually going to show this earlier work of Briferali et al. And they sort of saw something like Richardson. They have one advantage over the experiments is that they can take their particle separations to be whatever they want. Okay, so they studied particle separations all the way down here to 1.2 eta, 1.2 Kolmogorov distances. Maybe Eberhard would say they took them too small. I don't know, because now you're getting into the dissipation range. But what they did see when they did that, especially for this smallest separation, is that, look, so here's the T-cubed prediction. It is starting to look like they're seeing something like T-cubed here. Okay. Now, they also see, and this is extremely important from the point of view of the spontaneous stochasticity phenomenon, they are seeing a tendency to forget what that initial separation is. All these trajectories are starting to collapse on top of each other, which means that if you go long enough, you don't remember what the initial separation was. The only thing is they're not collapsing onto T cubed. Okay. So, pardon?
Is that a straight line there, T cubed?
This straight line is T cubed, absolutely. So only here could you claim that you see something sort of like T-cubed.
So it's bigger than T-cubed then?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you're also seeing sort of large-scale advection effects probably by then, smooth exponential, you know, divergence and stuff like that. I don't know. So anyways, if you look at the separations, they're much more successful, however. So if you look at the separations here, they actually fall very nicely on the Richardson prediction, which is, again, parameter-free fit here. Okay. So it looks like you do see this stretched exponential PDF. Okay. So now, I've done my own study of this. This is probably my first numerical experiment that I've ever presented, so let's see. I did all this by myself, and the reason I could do all this by myself, although I'm not numerically the strongest person in the world, less so than some of my colleagues, it was actually easy to do because we have this nice turbidence database at Johns Hopkins where we have all this data stored. We've actually got a Taylor scale Reynolds number of 433, so this is actually about half of what the maximum Taylor scale that Rick Eberhard's group looked at. And so what I did is very simple. I just put in at, particles at a set of points. All the particles, I took 1024 particles, all starting at the same point. The results are average. Actually, here I say 256. Actually, I increased that. This is an old slide. I went up to 512, and the results don't change. But I then solved the stochastic advection problem. So what's different from what the previous work numerically and experimentally is that I do not start the particles off with some separation. I start all the particles off at the same location, but to every particle I add an independent realization of this noise. Okay, and so then they start to separate under the effect of this random advection. Now, what happens now is you don't have a bachelor regime. At early times, this Brownian motion term dominates, and you've got linear diffusion. So the particles separate, the mean square separation grows linearly in time. In fact, analytically, in three dimensions, it grows like 12 kappa t. Okay, and that's actually what these green lines show. Here I've got results for two different choices of kappa or two different choices of Prandtl number, Prandtl number 1 and Prandtl number 1/10. So kappa equals nu or 10 nu. And these straight green lines are just the prediction of what you would get from the Brownian motion. So that dominates at early times. And then very nicely, I was actually surprised to see this when I originally did it, it just bends right over into Richardson T cubed. Okay. I should also point out that what I've actually done here is I'm going backward in time. I have results forward in time as well. Here I'm showing backward in time results. It's known that Richardson diffusion happens faster backward in time. Okay. This has been seen in previous numerical studies. If I showed you the forward time results, I don't get quite as long range of T cubed, but I see T cubed there as well. Okay. But what's also extremely important, in fact, I would say, from my point of view, this is the most important plot you're going to see in my whole talk, okay? What's very important here is that when I look at different choices of kappa, okay, at long time, they bend over and they start approaching the same curve. So this is the analog of forgetting the initial conditions, okay? Now I'm forgetting what the strength of kappa is. Or from another point of view, if I think of it in the reverse way, that I'm taking kappa going to zero, what it's showing is that I'm taking kappa going to zero, and I'm looking at fixed times later, the trajectories stay random. They don't collapse onto a single trajectory. The RMS separation stays constant as I take the limit as kappa goes to zero.
Now, of course, understand why it's faster backward in time. That's what? Related to difference of an exponent on negative.
I don't know, I could give maybe some hand-waving explanation, I guess. It's sort of, I think, related to the negative skewness of the velocity field, right?
It also has a Lagrangian counterpart.
Right. I mean, I guess if you think about what that means, what for the longitudinal velocity increment is actually what separates the particles, which makes the distances grow, right? The longitudinal velocity increment is what separates the particles. If that tends to be negative, that means that they actually tend often to approach each other, because then the velocity increment is like this, forward in time. But backward in time, it changes sign, and so you actually get slightly pointed in the other direction, and there's a greater tendency to separate. That's my interpretation.
The experiments clearly come together first.
Pardon?
You have a bump going
down,
and then they fly.
In numerics too, that's what Schreimann, what is Boris,
right.
Makes it down and then
it goes up.
In 3D. But in 2D, it's always, because the flux is negative. So it's a flux sign.
Pardon?
It's a sign of flux.
Yes, right. Yeah.
You're monitoring the initial particle separation.
Well, there's no initial particle separation in my case.
But have you played with the initial velocity of the particles? I suppose that the particles are initially carried by the flow itself. If you inject them...
I'm not sure what you mean
the
by them.
There are tracers.
Yeah.
But you could inject them...
With some other velocity.
With some other velocity.
I could do that, yeah.
Itself.
I could do that, yeah.
Okay.
But I haven't tried it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, from my particular application...
You relax.
Pardon?
Oh, no, but then you need to put a law of relaxation, so it's not a tracer already. At that point, it's already not a tracer.
And I guess, you know, from my point of view, this is the right thing to do, for example, in terms of the scalar problem. This is actually how you would solve the scalar advection problem, as I'll show later, also how you solve the MHD equations, is by doing it the way that I did it here. And so I was mainly motivated by that application. So, but you could do lots of things, you know, so. Okay, and the other important thing is, again, I get Richardson's predictions for the PDF. Very nice, okay. So again, there's no fit. This is parameter free, and it actually fits quite well. Actually, the forward fits even better. My forward is almost lies directly on top of it. But the backward, there's some anomalies, particularly at small separations that I don't really understand. Pardon?
How does the constant agree with what we hit?
The constant?
Oh, the
reflectors. Oh, for the Richardson law?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I'd have to remember again. Here, for the backward case, I got something bigger. It was about 1.4. And for the forward case, I got something like 0.6.
I don't remember what our plot said.
I don't know. People, it's approximately the same as what other people have seen. So, I mean, for the forward and for the backward both. But I wouldn't claim a lot here, you know, for prefactors, because again, I've only averaged over 512 particle locations in the flow. And so my T cubed is actually very robust, but depending on the number of particles that I average over, my constant can change. So I'd need to do more averaging to say anything confidently about the constant, yes.
So you took all these 512 or 1,024 now, you said?
Well, I took 512 initial points, and for every initial point, I started 1024 particles. I then looked at all pairs of those 1024 particles, which is about, you know, 500,000 pairs, and then I looked at the separations between all of those, and I just calculated and tracked them.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. Okay, so that's the present status of the experimental and numerical evidence for this phenomenon of spontaneous stochasticity. Clearly, a lot more can be done to see whether this is true or not, but personally, I was very gratified to see this. I think this is sort of the most compelling numerical evidence that I've seen for the phenomenon so far. Okay, now let me switch gears. Okay, so that was the first half of the talk. How much time do I have?
17 minutes,
okay.
So,
yeah, okay, so now let's go to the other half of the talk, MHD. Okay, so in this audience, I don't have to say a lot about these equations. We've all heard them about them many times in many of the previous talks yesterday. Here I've actually written them out for the incompressible case. Nothing that I'm going to say here actually depends on incompressibility. The important thing that I'm going to focus on in this talk is a specific property of those equations for the case that lambda is equal to zero, and this is the property pointed out by Alfvén in 1942, the magnetic flux is frozen in. Okay, it's actually very easy to prove this from those equations. If I just take this equation here, the induction equation, this is the Lagrangian derivative following the particles. If I drop this term, then what I get is just this equation. But this is exactly the same equation that follows for a little material line vector. If I put a particle x1 at the tip of the vector and a particle x2 at the tail of the vector, and I let that track along in the flow, then the equation that that little line vector satisfies is just obtained by taking the difference of those velocities. And when that's a little infinitesimal line vector, it satisfies this equation, which is the same as that equation. And so that means that magnetic field vectors in the flow just look like little material vectors carried along by the fluid. Okay. And it's been said that this is the most important property of an ideal plasma. Okay. For example, this is a quote from Colstrid. It's actually very useful. Here are some of the standard applications in astrophysics. For example, we saw from the talk yesterday those beautiful Archimedean spirals of the magnetic field and the solar wind, and you can understand that from flux freezing. Lots of phenomena observed in astrophysics can be explained by this. But now I think it should already be clear from what I've said in the talk that in a turbulent flow, there's something fundamentally wrong. Okay, this just cannot be right. Why? Because I've hoped that I've already convinced everybody that in high conductivity plasmas, or, you know, so the molecular diffusivity is now the analog of that kappa in my previous discussion. In the limit where kappa, or magnetic diffusivity, goes to zero, the particle trajectories do not become deterministic. They do not have to become deterministic. They stay random. So if the magnetic field lines are frozen in, to which of the trajectories are they frozen in? Okay. It doesn't make sense. There's some fundamental conflict between this spontaneous stochasticity phenomena and the standard flux freezing relation. It just can't be true anymore in a turbulent flow with this kind of Richardson phenomenon. Okay, now, forget that theoretical problem for the moment. Let's just think about it from the point of view of observations. It's also known from the point of view of observations that flux freezing often fails. Okay, so there are lots of examples where it fails. Here I'm just considering one, a solar flare. So this is a little cartoon model of a solar flare. And the important thing here is that in this little cartoon model in particular, which is what people often believe something like this goes on, there's a topology change. So notice that the field lines are coming in here. They come like that. And you end up now with field lines that originally looked like this. And now they look like this and like that. Okay, and so you've changed the topology of the field lines. Now, if the field lines are frozen into a flow, which doesn't even have to be a smooth flow, as long as the flow is continuous, you can't change the topology. Okay, but in fact, in reality, you see topology changes happening very quickly. For example, in solar flares or coronal mass ejections, you have things like scales of time from 15 minutes to several hours. Okay, so this is just fundamentally in violation of the usual flux freezing. And there are lots of other examples. Okay, so here I've just listed some other examples where it's known that if you believe in flux freezing should hold, you just get wildly incorrect results compared with observations. By the way, this geometry here looks just like what Alex was talking about in his talk. So this little part here is exactly the same picture turned on its side that you saw yesterday in Alex Lazarian's talk, this little piece here. So this is where the reconnection is actually taking place, is right in this little vicinity here. Okay. Well, let's see. So is an MHD solution possible to the reconnection problem? It's usually, often these days, argued that you can't understand it from resistive MHD because it's just too slow. So here's actually a quote from Colesford's book. I don't know, we can read it. I guess he says, flux freezing is a very strong constraint of the behavior of magnetic fields in astrophysics. He said, this implies that lines do not break and their topology is preserved. The condition for flux freezing can be formulated as follows. In a time t, a line of force can slip through a plasma this distance. And if this distance is small compared to delta, the scale of interest, then flux freezing holds to a good degree of approximation. Okay, so this is actually a very, very common formula in the astrophysics literature to estimate through Spitzer resistivity how far the magnetic field lines actually slip through the plasma. If you take this formula and you take a solar flare with, say, length scale 10 to the fourth kilometers, and this is the Spitzer resistivity, and you use this equation to estimate the time for the lines to diffuse through this distance, it's about 3 million years. Okay, so far, far too long to explain what's seen in solar flares. And I would say that most people, a large community of people these days, think that, in fact, to explain these fast reconnection events, you have to go to something beyond standard MHD. You need to take into account collisionist effects, like the Hall MHD term, anomalous resistivity. In other words, other microscopic plasma physics processes. Now, you can actually improve this estimate that I just showed you. So there is this Sweet-Parker reconnection solution, which actually gets a faster rate than what I just showed you, because they realize, well, in fact, you don't actually need to diffuse the field lines over that total distance L. So here is the distance scale L of these two magnetic field configurations that are coming together. That's a large macroscopic distance. But by creating a very, very thin current sheet, you actually don't need to diffuse the lines through that whole distance L. You only need to diffuse them across this distance delta that separates the fields of opposite polarity. Okay. And this is slightly different derivation than the one that Alex gave the other day, but let's just go through a quick derivation of the Sweet-Parker scaling again. So as the magnetic field lines come in and then are carried out along this direction at the Alphane speed, they spend a time in this zone here, which is this Alphane crossing time. And you can ask yourself, under molecular diffusivity, as they diffusively separate by Spitzer resistivity, how far they would diffuse in that amount of time? Well, it's just this distance here, and that gives you an estimate of how thick that reconnection zone is. Okay, so this is, in fact, one of the derivations that Colesford gives of this result in his textbook in 2005. So this is not the same as the derivation that Alex showed the other day. It's a more Lagrangian derivation, if you like. okay, time temporal derivation. But you get the same problem because you still have the mass conservation constraint, and if you put this result together with that result, you get a final reconnection speed for leaving this reconnection zone, which goes down like 1/√ of the Lundquist numbers, and that kills you because in most astrophysical environments, the Lundquist number is incredibly large. So for example, for solar flares, you can estimate it something like 3×10^12, and if you put that together with the Alphane speed and you plug into these formulas, you find that the release time is still something like 2 years. Still too small. So there's been a lot of attempts to get around this, but there's a lot of pessimism that you can do this within MHD. But what about turbinates? The Sweet-Parker solution is laminar, okay? It's not turbinate. Everything here was completely laminar and smooth. And I think now everybody should have been preconditioned by what I said in the early part of the talk, is that this result here is not going to hold in a turbinate flow. The particles are not going to separate diffusively like T. They should separate in some other way. Now, I should actually formalize all this a little bit, because so far I haven't actually talked about how the magnetic field lines move, but it's very much like the scalar case that I showed earlier. The only difference from the scalar case is that you have this additional term here, which is the stretching term. That's the really significant difference. Of course, you also have this term here, but this is sort of the big problem here. For incompressible flow, this one is vanishing. Well, that means that in order to write down a path integral solution, you have to put in this extra Jacobian term, which you can actually get by now once you create these stochastic trajectories. You're now along a stochastic trajectory. You have to solve this equation. And when you put that matrix into this formula, that's an exact solution of this equation. Now, this looks a little messy, but actually, it's got a very elegant statement. This is actually equivalent to saying that you have a stochastic Alphane theorem. And what it says, if I want to know the magnetic flux through a loop at a given time t prime, I take these random flows and I advect the loop backward in time to the initial time. I look at all the fluxes through each one of those loops, and I then average them, and that actually gives the flux of the loop at the final time. So it turns out that this stochastic Alphane theorem is actually mathematically equivalent to this condition, this equation here. They're just restatements of each other. So it's sort of a Lagrangian way of interpreting this equation. Okay. Another way of interpreting this equation is through a stochastic Lundquist formula. So if I didn't have randomness, if I was talking about ideal MHD, this would just be the standard Lundquist formula. In the presence of resistivity, what changes is now I have to add randomness to the trajectories. And so when I want to solve for the magnetic field at a point, what I have to do is I have to create this ensemble of trajectories. They go back to the starting time, and I have these starting magnetic field vectors. I then transport them through this formula along those random trajectories, just like you usually do, to the final point, okay, where they actually generally get stretched and grow. But then to get the resultant magnetic field, I have to do one final step. I have to average those to get the final magnetic field. Okay? So this is what replaces the usual Lundquist formula in the case in the presence of resistivity. Okay, now, for a laminar MHD solution with small resistivity, this is almost the same as the standard Lundquist formula, because all these trajectories would collapse almost on top of each other. There would just be a little bit of Brownian jitter around them. And so I would basically recover the standard Lundquist formula if the velocity field is smooth and if I take lambda going to zero. But in the turbinate flow, these things do not collapse. Yes?
Is it possible to see from this formula directly that at infinite time, for some configurations, you will go to zero magnetic field, right?
So what will happen?
For resistive MHD, for some configurations, at infinite time, you will go to zero magnetic field. Is it easy to see from?
It's no easier to see from this formula than from any other way of writing down the MHD equations. I mean, I don't know. You'd have to show me the specific problem you're interested in, but this is equivalent to writing down the standard induction equation.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So you say zero helicity magnetic field configuration should decay to zero magnetic field at infinite time.
You're saying, is it directly easy to see from this formula? I don't know. Off the top of my head, I can't give a direct explanation, but this is equivalent. I mean, in some sense, I don't know, for any particular use of, you know, some problem, you take whatever formulation of the MHD equations is the most convenient one. So.
Yes, if you write it with a propagator, like you write it for theta field, for basic scalar, you can have an analog of it. It's a vector, you need to take modulus and all this, but is it, and since the propagator actually spreads, then you get it decay.
You're talking about the passive case or the full nonlinear case?
No, the full nonlinear case.
Full nonlinear case.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think the important thing here is what happens now in the limit as lambda goes to zero. Do these collapse or not? Now, what I would like to show you is that you have an analog of Richardson, but of course I don't have any numerical results to present. In fact, there's been relatively little theory on this, or experiment or numerical work about it. I think experiments would probably be pretty hard, but maybe possible. But there has been some numerical study of this. Let me say, however, you can do a little bit of phenomenological theory. So, 5 minutes, okay, I'll try to go quick. So actually, let's take the same Goldreich-Sweetheart theory that Andre talked about yesterday, in which case the velocity increments actually scale just like in Kolmogorov theory in the perpendicular direction to the magnetic field. Well, then you can actually do the same kind of argument that I did at the beginning to estimate how rapidly the magnetic fields will separate in that lateral direction with this kind of scaling. Well, because this is just like K41, you get Richardson diffusion again. Okay, so the argument is identical, and at least if you believe in GS95, then for the perpendicular separation of the field lines in the direction perpendicular to the magnetic field, it should look just like Richardson. Actually, you probably expect in the parallel direction it's slower because the velocity field is smoother in the parallel direction. You've got a 1/2 power instead of a 1/3. So at least initially, as the particles separate, if they're initially separated only along the field direction, it should just actually separate in a slower way, according to this law. And these predictions are actually in qualitative agreement with the numerical studies. But it certainly would be very important to study this further to understand in detail whether these kinds of predictions are correct or not. Okay. Okay, I should say, by the way, that from this point in the talk, everything is actually joint work with Alex here and Ethan in Canada, whichever direction Canada is. I don't know where I'm pointing. Pardon? Okay. Oh, yes. Okay, so the idea here is very simple. Let's just try to repeat what we did for Sweet Parker, but assuming a background MHD turbulence. Okay, so we'll take the RMS velocity fluctuation here to be less than the Alphane velocity, and then we've also got some injection scale, L sub F. Well, let's just repeat the same kind of derivation I gave before, but replace the diffusive separation with this Richardson-type separation. Okay, so again, the field lines will spend a time here given by the Alphane crossing time, and the question is we have to estimate the width of that reconnection layer by saying how far can they diffuse by this Richardson diffusion. Well, I can take this result, I plug in this result from Krejci in 1965 that actually Alex wrote down the other day. When I substitute this into here, what pops out is this formula, and if I plug that into mass conservation, I get this formula, and amazingly enough, these are exactly the same formulas that Alex derived yesterday. Okay, so this derivation, although it's different than the one that Alex showed, recovers precisely their result. You just replace the molecular diffusion of the field lines with Richardson diffusion, and their prediction pops out. I should say here that I've looked at the strong GS95 turbulence regime. You can also look at a corresponding weak turbulence regime and do a similar calculation, and amazingly enough, they agree there as well. Okay. If you now take this formula and you take the case of solar flares, for example, with the forcing scale comparable to the flare size, the loop size, and then you take UL estimated to be about 0.1 VA, actually you can justify that from observations, then you actually find a release time of about 1 hour. So now we've closed the gap and we actually get realistic release times. Okay. Let me just say quickly that the way that Lazarin and Vishniak originally derived this theory was a little different. They looked at the wandering of magnetic field lines to estimate the size of the reconnection zone because, of course, plasma follows magnetic field lines, and so the way that the plasma emerges has to be along magnetic field lines. And so that's how they estimated the size of the reconnection zone. That actually turns out to be an exact analog of spontaneous stochasticity, but for the field lines themselves. So if you actually say, if I start on two field lines separated initially by some perpendicular distance L perp 0, and then I go along an arc length along the field lines, you can ask, how far do they diffuse apart? Well, that should go like the delta B over B0, because they actually, if you're moving an arc length, you're going along with the unit vector in the direction of the magnetic field. That's in GS95 given by this. You plug in the formula, and what you actually get out is a kind of Richardson diffusion for the field lines themselves. And I guess this means I'm out of time. So actually, it turns out that what GS95 was considering was actually spontaneous stochasticity of the field lines. Okay, spontaneous stochasticity. In other words, in the limit that you're considering, there's actually more than one magnetic field line that emerges from every point. And I don't think I have time to talk about the Hall term and why that's negligible. Let me just conclude here. And thank you for your attention.
Yes. Oh, we have time for question, please.
No, we have time for question.
Okay, all right. So, Goldreich Sridhar essentially is about equivalent to spontaneous.
I wouldn't say it's equivalent. I'm saying that there, I mean, actually almost any theory of MHD turbulence leads to similar predictions.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter whether you took the Roshnikov creation or whether you took Bolyarev's revision of Goldreich. As long as the velocity field is rough.
It's rough, okay.
Yeah, so basically it corresponds to having an energy spectrum with a spectral exponent like k to the minus 1 to k to the minus 3.
Yeah. But then for the Goldreich, that you said it's like almost like Richardson thing.
Yeah, well, in that case, it turns out that in that particular case, you get something which looks exactly like classical Richardson.
I was curious how far the Iroshnikov Cracknell differ from this.
Well, yeah, I mean, in that case, you'd have a 1/4 exponent, so what would it actually give? I'd have to think about it a little bit. I mean, I should be able to do the calculation, but okay. I think...
Will it be slower than Richardson?
It will probably be faster, I guess, because the velocity field is rougher. Right?
Okay.
So remember, you have a 1/4 exponent,
that's
and so you actually should... In other words, what will happen is you'll actually get something in which the exponent of the growth is smaller, but that actually turns out to be faster growth.
Yeah.
Because you have to divide everything by the integral time scale.
Yes,
and so it'll actually give you something faster, yes.
So how do you, so in a Richardson dispersion, which we know, I mean, what you said is happening from your example, it happens at very, very small scales, and then there's a transient time, and then you go to the Richardson regime.
Right, yeah, that's
so
what
in your case, you have a transient time. How does the transient time for the plasma physics case compare?
How does the transient time for what?
How does that transient time compare with the time you calculate out of your 1 hour?
But
you need to check
to make sure
you have a comment to Richardson, or whether the whole thing is over by the time.
No, but that time is extremely small. Okay, we could calculate it, but it's extremely small. It's extremely small. I mean, you can see that by the fact that if we assume that you had sort of this diffusion over that sort of the whole time, it would take a million years to separate. I mean, I'd have to go back and calculate. We have the numbers here.
No, but it would be decent.
It'll be very short time. It'll be a very, very small time to get out through this.
In the non-turbulence case, right, this time is because you also have the bachelor time. As soon as you have a finite separation, actually, you get a bachelor time, which you also have in the plasma physics case. It's unavoidable. And so you need long time scales.
Okay, well, let me put it this way, that again, the Reynolds numbers in, say, the solar flare case, or say the Lundquist numbers are like 10 to the 12. You know, what I was looking at in my numerical experiment was Kähler-Scale Reynolds numbers of 400, right?
Well, you square it, your Reynolds number is not a Taylor microscale Reynolds number, it's a
decrease. Yeah, so you could take a square root of that, so it's still a million, right?
Okay,
very high. So I'm saying that you've got plenty of time, much more than in my numerical experiment where I saw that phenomenon. I'd have to sit down and actually work out.
So in other words, Richardson can be very important for astrophysics, but perhaps not on Earth.
Well, I wouldn't even agree with that, because it depends on what you're looking at. If you look at these stochastic trajectories, which means I'm solving the scalar advection equation, so that's just a way of understanding the solution of the scalar advection equation, I see it at Taylor scale 433. Now, if you're talking about the separation of real particles from a finite-sized source... Yeah, that's a different issue. But if you're talking about solving the scalar advection equation...
If you worry about what people do with pollution, you actually take the TQ plot.
I was just wondering, because you have these flux lines, and you're talking about, you have these loops, and then you have the flux being frozen in, and then you had to go backwards in time to do an ensemble average to figure out what the flux would be. But in that case, you don't have stochasticity. Like, you don't, what are you ensemble averaging over? Because you have one velocity.
That's stochasticity. Okay. So, I mean, in my case, I add a random noise to the trajectories, right?
Small, but not zero.
So I'm averaging Brownian motion. So every particle gets an independent Brownian attached to it.